The Tea Stop In podcast series is inspired by the memory of the last surviving founder of the Australian Cinematographer Society, my friend, the late John Leake ACS. When he and his wife Marion retired from the film industry, they bought a little motel outside Sydney, and it became a tradition for cinematographers and other filmmakers to stop in and have relaxed conversations about the industry and the craft of cinematography. It earned the nickname of the Tea Stop In. This series sets out to recapture the spirit of those conversations. But this time, we're inviting you to listen in.
The Tea Stop In.
I'm Ben Allen, and welcome to The Tea Stop In. Frieda Hockheim is one of those rare people that's actually changed the way that movies are made. When he founded Kinoflow Lighting Systems, fluorescent lights were considered to be one of the worst light sources for film. Frieda worked closely with Kodak to understand how film actually saw colours and tuned the fluorescent lights to be able to properly render colours on film. In the process, he made things possible that weren't previously possible, like working with very soft light in small spaces. Now he's applying the same rigorous scientific approach to LED lights and digital cameras and solving some baffling colour issues in the process. Frieda, welcome to the Tea Stop In.
Thank you for having me.
I remember when I first started using Kinoflow lights, coming from, you know, primarily using tungsten and a little bit of HMI, and it made such a difference. I was suddenly getting better pictures than I was getting previously, and everything was happening faster. I suspect that's not the first time you've heard that from a DOP.
No, but the introduction was challenging at first, to go from a technology that was rather vilified. Color was bad. It made noise. Every sound mixer would walk in and say, "You're not going to use those lights up there, are you?" No. We'll turn it all off. Don't worry. But the fact that it was soft light, the fact that we cleaned up the spectrum, that it harmonized with motion picture stock, that was a clincher. And the fact that it was lightweight and you could achieve a quality of light that it would normally require 15, 20 square feet of space on a set.
Yep.
The fact that you could just put up a board with that emanated light, especially in tight locations.
That light, that softness was there straight out of the box.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so that cleaning up that spectrum, that process of doing that, what did that involve?
It involved, first of all, understanding what does film actually see. And so the first step towards understanding that was to call up Kodak.
Yeah.
Say, "Here, I'm this guy with a fluorescent tube, and I'd love to make it work on film stock." I said, "Well, we have a spectrometer here, and it tells you what filtration you have to put on, and it'll clean it up." I said, "Okay."
And Kodak had a fantastic tradition of being very open with that sort of information.
They were very cooperative. Yeah. I came in and said, "Well, I'd actually like to alter the spectrum, and just looking at it, what do I need to do?" And so Mitch Bogdanovich at Kodak at the time said, "Well, this is what you're going to have to do to your spectrum." So not being a scientist myself or an engineer, I managed to get an engineer who actually knew his way around phosphors and translated between what Kodak talked in general terms, "We need to lift this portion of the spectrum or repress this," translated that to, or communicated that to an engineer who actually knew how to blend phosphors. And then a little bit of back and forth with Kodak and said, "Let's do the tests." And finally they came up and said, "You got it."
Wow. And you have background as a gaffer before that.
I did the film school thing. I was a graduate of Ryerson University in Toronto and went very quickly into gaffing. I'd pulled focus. I worked in a film lab. I did all kinds of odd jobs, all of them related to, in some way, shape, or form to film. I worked in a film distribution company. I needed to understand various aspects, especially being young. You go into the industry, you go, "I have no idea where this is going to go." But I do love making images. Since the age of 5, I was in a dark room. So
yeah,
that's part of my DNA.
Since those days, there's, in recent years, some really massive things have changed. And I guess three elements of that is that digital projection has made a huge change to the industry away from film prints, digital cameras, and now LED lights as well. How have you seen that transition happening?
Yeah. Well, we've gone, our entire industry has undergone a huge transformation. Silver halides are out. hard drives are in.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, digital projection. I mean, the entire industry, from delivery, the entire studio business model is changing.
Mm.
You've got Netflix, you've got Hulu, you've got Amazon, Apple. The entire industry has been turned on its head. And so within the lighting industry, LEDs, they've been around for a little bit. They started off being very inadequate and increasingly have become getting better and better. And I think technology-wise on LEDs, we're at that point now where we really need to understand what the camera needs to render image correctly. With the LED, you can now achieve a color quality or a spectral quality that is conducive to good imaging.
So this is something I haven't really heard people talk about before in terms of relating the output of lights to what the camera sees and how that's different to film and different between cameras.
KinoFlow came about because we understood what film saw.
Mm.
Kodak and Fuji understood the necessity or the advantage, let's say, of cooperating with us and saying, here are the spectral response curves. If we're coming up with a new film stock, here are the new curves, just so that we could stay relevant with this evolution of imaging technology.
Mm.
And so that kind of a working relationship was really fantastic. And it was great for the industry because what we produced worked. And so as we then moved into electronic cinema and the questions arose, well, what about the spectral quality of these cameras?
Mm.
And we were basically poo-pooed. We're saying, oh, don't worry. Think of it just like, it's just like film. Well, we knew that it wasn't like film. We could see that. Yet they would not articulate what those differences were. So from our perspective, the real challenge was, well, we're in the dark. I'm just not going to go ahead and produce a light because I think it's going to be okay. We need to show that it's okay. How do we prove it?
Mm.
So I went back to Kodak, but it wasn't anymore Kodak. It was now Mitch Bogdanovich, who had retired.
Right. Wow.
So, Mitch, I need your help. Remember that great spectrometer you guys built? Let's build another one, but let's, instead of putting in the film curves, let's put in the camera curves. Wow. How can we do that?
Wow. And in terms of, we're talking about spectral response of cameras, you know, what does that mean to people? Because, you know, I think generally, even in the industry, we tend to think a color's a color. And it's not necessarily the case, is it?
No. So our eye has a way of seeing color. It's red, green, blue. Film had a way of seeing color, red, green, blue. And once you actually understand the spectral response of those three curves, you start to understand a little more about what film could see.
Mm.
Film, there were certain colors film could not see.
That's an interesting point. I once had a conversation with Andrew Lesney when he was talking about there's a gap in the spectrum in that area between blue and magenta on film, on color negative film. And part of that could be reproduced by the print stock, but not by the camera negative stocks. And when they were digitally grading the first Lord of the Rings film, there was a scene early on in the film that they pushed into that part of the spectrum. And he said he was very excited about it because it's colors that nobody had ever seen on a cinema screen before.
Right.
I found that fascinating.
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, back in the 20th century, we actually did camera tests. We ensured that the film stock was of the same batch number. We went to great lengths to make sure that batch numbers were the same. We stuck with the same lab. We had the same colorist throughout the show. We tested the camera, the same set of lenses on the show. So we tried to take out as many variables as possible. And you'd bring in the art department. You settled on a color palette that you knew was reproducible.
Mm.
You don't want surprises on the set and find out next day, why is that color looking so weird? So that's what pre-production is about. And when you look at what happens with a lot of production now, they give you 2-3 days, and you really don't have that kind of opportunity to dig down and make sure that everyone's on the same page as to what's reproducible.
Yeah. And so a lot of those problems, if they're not being solved on set, then end up being color grading issues.
Well, this is where the chaos begins. It starts with, first of all, everyone understanding every cinema camera is like a different film stock. We chose Kodak over Fuji or Fuji over Kodak or within Kodak different film stocks because they had different spectral qualities that were conducive to a certain image quality you were aiming for. And these are all conscious decisions on the part of a director of photography. It wasn't the producer's decision. They never decide that. They didn't know. Yet now, every producer seems to know that it's important to work with XYZ or whatever camera because he's got a good deal on it, not understanding the creative implications and the technical implications. And that later on will also play into budget, where it may seem like a great budget move to get a camera package for a good price. That does have some implications in post, and those are all costs that are very difficult to project in a budget. It's that unknown factor.
Yes.
And that I think this is one of the bigger challenges.
So you've been looking at the spectral response of some of the major high-end cameras that are out there. How much difference is there?
There are surprising differences. And when you look at their spectral response curves, they're simply different. And in that difference, you can explain why certain cameras see certain colors in a distinct way.
So when a cinematographer says, I like this particular type of camera because of the way it renders skin tones, there's actually something scientific behind that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we can actually show you what those differences are. And I think, here's the thing. All of these cameras do a great job of reproducing images and color quality. Yet there are subtle nuances which only really get into your eye once you're in the color grading suite or in a dark room and you're looking at that screen and you're looking at a skin tone and you're going, I didn't see that on the day. What is that? Can I take it out or can I? Or there was something that I saw. Why can't I get that? So if the camera is not capable of recording a certain wavelength of light, you cannot generate it later. Either it's there or it's not.
And when we're talking about skin tones, that's potentially a hugely significant thing.
To what we discovered is this. I think it's very important to have as full a spectrum of white Kelvin as possible. You can construct spectrum through various narrow bands and hope to get it. It's possible, but are you getting the full breadth of tones that are in that skin tone? And the more continuous that spectral quality is, the better chance you have of pulling out all those subtle nuances in skin tone. And this is really that's the primary focus of what we're trying to do, is make sure that we can ensure the best color quality off of skin tone.
So if there's variations in the spectral response of these different digital cameras, what's the implication of that for you in designing these lighting fixtures?
We looked at a lot of different ways of creating white light. And I do a presentation in which we show 15 different ways of showing white light. Yet everything comes with a certain amount of baggage. And so the goal is to try to present as wide a spectrum as possible. We've taken our approach. Other manufacturers have taken their approach. And in some of the instances, the white spectrum is narrower. It doesn't have as much spectrum. And you actually see that on a skin tone when you do side-by-side comparisons. So I think we're on a good track with where we are. We use two full spectrum whites together with RGB elements. And those RGBs are used to raise the color point and basically track the response of the camera. So I illustrate that our eye... That white Kelvin follows a Plankian curve as the eye would see it. Cameras do follow a similar curve, similar to a Plankian, but it's predicated on the response of the camera, not the response of the eye. And we see that in some cases, a color point can be above what we would say is above the Plankian curve, and it'll end up in the daylight slightly below the Plankian curve. So there's no consistency necessarily. I think that represents some of the challenges. And when you think you've got it figured out, because in 3200 we're fine, and all I have to do now is hold that ratio and zip it over into daylight, and you find out that it doesn't hold true.
Wow. What are some of the potential pitfalls of mixing different color temperatures with light sources, with LED light sources?
Again, there's certain creative reasons for doing things, but if you're trying to be consistent, then it's more the challenge of mixing different manufacturers. So we can illustrate that you can be on the same XY coordinate between manufacturers, and you say, according to the meter, we're spot on. But because they've used different techniques in achieving that white light quality, the inconsistency in how broad that spectrum really is, those differences start to show up. So you can be on the same XY coordinate, yet use different ways of achieving white light, and it's still not a match.
I can envisage a situation on set where perhaps you had sources from different manufacturers in different areas of the set, and you had an A camera that was maybe one brand of camera, and then, say, a different brand of camera for a high-speed shot. And the high-speed shot's coming in at a different angle. So there's one manufacturer's spectrum of light hitting the dominant side of the,
right,
the subject on B manufacturer's high-speed camera, and another spectrum of light hitting it, the other side. And there's potentially a world of pain to be had there.
A lot of pain. This is, it's no different from the 20th century when we mixed Kodak and Fuji and went, why isn't this matching up? Because you're not sticking to one palette here. Mm. You know, you're not. Mm. In my presentation, I talk about Rembrandt and Vermeer. You know, the cinematographers are the modern day Vermeers and Rembrandts, or pick an artist. You know, they chose a distinct group of pigments with which they would work in. They just didn't pick up anything that was on the market. They were very calculating as to how they would work. And I think the color science of these instruments is the modern day pigment.
Mm.
And once you start mixing these things up on a set, you're starting to build complexity into it. So as example, we now are introducing camera lookup capabilities on our instrument, meaning we are embedding the color science into our fixtures so that it'll harmonize to a certain camera.
Wow.
And with that, we're giving you a neutral Kelvin starting point. So you don't have to worry about, is it going to be slightly magenta, slightly green? It's going to be neutral. We give you plenty of other controls. You can now do anything you want with it. You can mess it up any way you like, but we're at least going to give you a starting point. So what Kodak did by embedding their color science in the film emulsion, we're saying, we're going to do that and embed it in the instrument to start with.
Wow.
And from there, you can be creative and do whatever you want with it, but at least we're going to give you a clean starting point.
So that's fascinating to me, because LUTs are something that, you know, started off purely in post and have kind of migrated into the cameras. That the idea of a LUT migrating now into the light sources themselves is, it's quite mind-boggling at first, but then very interesting, exciting. How would that work in practice? Like you would literally go, okay, I'm using this brand of camera, this type of camera, and so I'll load into the lamps the LUT for that spectral output of the...
For example.
Yeah.
John Schwartzman, ASC, was just doing a show in London.
Hmm.
It's an Emma Thompson project, shooting with a Panavision DXL. All the kinos that were on the set were harmonized to the DXL. So essentially you go into a setup menu, pick the DXL, which means now this instrument is optimized spectrally for the DXL.
Wow.
John came back raving because in post, everything looked the way he expected it to look.
Wow.
We just recently did a commercial there as well, where this time working on Alexa, harmonized everything to the Alexa.
Hmm.
And where normally the grader would go in and start playing with it, because fully expecting a cacophony of different color responses from different instruments, he went, there was really nothing to do other than go back to the original color settings, and it looked great.
Wow.
Why was that? And he said, well, we were all on the same color.
Wow.
Everything was adjusted to the camera. So that was, to the colorist, was mind-blowing, because that, he said, most of our life is we're dealing with three and four different manufacturers, and we're trying to balance out these elements that are incongruous with what
the intent was.
And how do we best compromise that and come close to the vision of the cinematographer?
And of course, all the time that they spend doing that is time that they're not spending being creative and adding to what's being done.
Exactly.
So it's, I think, certainly as someone who grades as well as shoots, it's frustrating when you're fixing problems rather than being creative and building on what's been done on set.
Yeah. So I think, taking to heart what we were told, oh, it's just like film. Well, it isn't, and we know now why and how we are best able to address that incongruity and give a tool set that makes life, it takes a certain amount of concern off the table and allows you to focus on what's really important.
Yeah, it's removing variables from the system so that you can actually have a much more predictable, controllable result.
Yeah, I think creativity is about control.
Yes.
Although there's something to be said for no control, because you discover things
Yeah, the happy accidents. Yeah.
I'll give you a great example. Robbie Mueller shooting The American Friend. Mm. There's a scene on the pool table, very green. And I've gone back and looked at that shot multiple times, and I realize why it got so green. It's a tracking shot where you come across a window out, and you're looking out into it's an exterior view outside. Mm. It's a heavy overcast day. That Kelvin outside the window must have been upwards of 8,000-9,000 degrees Kelvin. Heavy yep. overcast.
Yep.
Tracks along. He's got a cool white in this fixture, and Robbie said, "We had no gels, so I just went with what we had." He couldn't see how green it was.
Yeah.
There was no way. Mm. And so when it finally came into balancing that scene out, most of the scene takes place against this window and then ends up at this pool table. So he corrected for this high Kelvin light outside the window.
Yeah.
And I guess he had some HMIs inside to just sort of balance out against the exterior window. But by the time he got to that pool table, he was so far off what was exterior. Yeah. It was popping green. And it was
and that's what it had to be.
Yeah. And Robbie was the type of cinematographer that would embrace something like that and go,
wow.
No, I'm not going to lose my job over this because it now looks so green. No, we're going to embrace it. We're actually going to work with this as a creative element.
Mm.
And so that takes a certain amount of courage. And I think he created an aesthetic shift in our industry where it was okay to be green. And so those are true. Those happy accidents,
yeah.
Which if you were trying to control a scene, you would never do that.
Yeah. And that's going with the flow. But at the same time, that's kind of different to having systemic flaws in the process. And
yeah.
And I guess that's where it's quite exciting, this idea of having that greater consistency and more finely tuned light sources to work with is very exciting in terms of also just being able to push the envelope.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the things that has happened with the transition to digital, because I think there's, for a lot of cinematographers, there's this feeling of kind of losing their footing a bit because film was so consistent. Like you treat it the same way, the result was going to be pretty close each time.
Again, embedding the science in the emulsion.
Yep.
All you had to do was expose it.
And you know, there was Kodak and there was Fuji and there was a few different stocks.
Agfa.
Yeah. There's a few different stocks within each of the brands and they would have their distinct look. But once you got to know the look of the stock you were working with or the stocks that you were working with, it was a very reliable system. And now there are so many variables. It would be hard to even quantify how many variables there are. And so I think anything that starts to give people more confidence in eliminating some of the variables right from, you know, the light source through to post is very good in terms of giving people more confidence to take risks and push the envelope a bit. And I think what I've noticed with a lot of cinematographers, certainly not all, there are certainly people who are out there taking risks and pushing the envelope, but a lot of cinematographers, particularly experienced cinematographers, have tended to pull back a bit and play it safe with the shift to digital when, in fact, there's probably room for them to take more risks. Something that probably plays into that is these different spectral responses. And so they'll do the same thing and try to treat it the same way in post, but they're using a different camera, a different brand of LED light source and get a different response.
Yeah. From that. What we're aiming for is predictability.
Yeah.
If we can give you the confidence to know that today I work with this light and tomorrow it's going to do the same thing when I do this to it.
Yep.
That's important.
Today I'm using this light with an Alexa and tomorrow I'm using that light with a Red, that it's going to be able to be tuned to deliver much more accurate response on both of those cameras, I think is... It's one of those things that fills a cinematographer with confidence that they can, from that very stable starting point, jump off and take risks.
Yeah. I think what's still also what producers really need to understand is you need to give the cinematographer the luxury, and it isn't even really it shouldn't be a luxury. They need the time to do the camera test because if you want to have any consistency or predictability and confidence in what you're doing in your production, have the courtesy, maybe that's the word, have the courtesy to allow the cinematographer to do the camera tests that are so necessary, because it does play into the budget. Mm. You don't have to clean it up later as much. You don't have to spend the time in post. Mm. And it's that predictability factor that I think is very important. You don't want surprises.
Mm. Now, I know you've done a lot of research into color gamut, and that's something that, again, like with LUTs, is something that I would think about as being display technology or camera technology. I'd never really thought about gamut playing into light sources, but of course it does.
Very much. In the LED world, there are a limited number of color emitters that are available. You can, if you want to expand the gamut and give, again, let's go back a little further. Let's just say everything that at KinoFlow we design as a task light. What is the task? Mm. So in our case, with most of our line, well, with all of our line at this point, it's about full spectrum white. Let's give you a consistent full spectrum white. In order to do that, we need to use RGB elements in order to raise the color point to help balance out the color as it tracks across the full Kelvin range. And as a bonus, you can get all these party colors. Great. Now, if the intent, though, is to have party colors, we would design a completely different fixture.
Mm.
It would not work with just one, like RGB. We would most probably introduce a lot of different wavelengths to try to expand that capability of hitting all those different lights. The advantage of a tungsten source is that it's a broad continuous source of spectrum, and putting gels on it, you're basically knocking out all the other colors except that one wavelength of light that it's letting through. So if it's yellow, it's letting through that narrow band of yellow. If you're trying to achieve that same color of yellow by blending green and red, well, now it really becomes dependent on what exactly those color positions are. Now you're already limited by availability of those two color points. And what we're seeing for ourselves is trying to expand that spectrum. There's cost involved, because if you're trying to hit a certain wavelength of green, and the yield from trying to fabricate that is only 20% yield, wow, that's a huge cost factor. Mm. So now, if the sole purpose is to, or the key purpose is to give a full spectrum white, and yet at the same time you want to do a wonderful yellow or whatever color it may be, and you start adding cost to it, is it going to be sustainable in the market?
Mm, mm. I guess how much need is there for those specific kind of colors? Is that important enough?
Well, here's the funny part about it. You can get all those colors by throwing a gel on a full spectrum white light.
Mm.
So
now here's a question. If you have a light that's not full spectrum, so it's giving you, let's say, daylight, but you've got variations through the spectrum, and you put a gel on that, what's going to be the result of that? Is that going to be a consistent result?
It'll be about as close a result as having, say, an HMI, if we're talking in the daylight realm. Mm. Having an HMI and putting a gel on it, you could approximate that pretty well with an LED in daylight. Again, depending on how that LED spectrum is constructed, if it has a very deep dip around the 475, 480, it may not do it as well as an HMI, because an HMI has more spectrum in that exact zone. But the likelihood is that it'll be a pretty close match. It should be fine.
So there's still a place for gels.
Surprisingly, you know, and I think that's the irony of all this. You know, on the one hand, we're saying, oh, look, I can generate all these colors, yes, but if you're going to be very critical and you start looking at exactly those wavelengths that are reproducible, you go, well, time out. You're going to be able to hit some of them. But you, again, goes back to 20th century, have you done, you know, you've got to do your camera test. So if there's a particular wavelength of color you want, you damn well better do the camera test beforehand. Otherwise, on the set, you'll be standing there with egg on your face because it's not reproducing. Why isn't it? Well, maybe you should have that gel standing by just to throw on that full spectrum white source.
Yeah. So, yeah, as you say, party colors, fine. But if you want to nail a specific color, which, you know, let's face it, is a pretty common thing.
Yeah. Well, again, you can do it through gel.
Yeah.
That's most probably going to be your most accurate.
Mm.
Well, not necessarily accurate. It's one way, and you're ensured that you're going to pretty much be able to reproduce any of the gel colors because it's a gel on continuous light.
Yeah.
But if you're trying to generate it through RGB or RGB amber or RGB rose red, red, lime green, green, and so on and so forth,
Yeah. Maybe not so much.
Do your camera test.
Yeah, yeah. And so also in terms of, again, consistency, so if you are relying on gels to get a very, very specific colour in the light, having that light source, the fixture, tuned to the spectral response of the camera is going to give you much more accuracy in that, presumably.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so for cinematographers who have their favourite gels, you know, like putting a half straw on the fill light to warm things up, that you'd be able to do that and get probably much closer to what you would expect on film.
Yeah, the beauty of having the ability to now adjust hue angle and saturation is that with, just for example, working in daylight, bastard amber is always one of those colors on a skin tone, gave you that extra little warmth that you wanted. Sometimes it wasn't enough and you'd say, well, what do I do now? I've only got gels. Could you double it up? Oh, go. Looks, it's too much. Okay, go back to what we had. Oh, we'll just live with this. Oh, we'll try to warm it up in post. You know, now you can dial it in on your instrument, and you can incrementally increase the hue, the saturation. You can play with it, and then now it's a new aesthetic process that you go through, and it no longer is a bastard amber. It's now the bastard amber got you into that zone where you thought you wanted to be. But now you can specifically tune in to an individual skin tone and make that adjustment. And now you have a numeric reference point through hue angle and saturation that can be notated.
So that can be repeated.
And it can be repeated.
Mm.
So that is the mind-blowing part of all of this technology, which we could never do before, which is really exciting.
Yeah, because it's a huge thing that, again, I think was very stable with film to be able to go, okay, well, we can repeat this. We're going to shoot on this stock and I'm going to set the exposure here, the key to fill ratio is going to be this. We're going to push it a stop. It's going to be printed onto this stock, and you know what the result's going to be. And so anything that kind of reintroduces a bit of, even in a different part of the process, reintroduces a bit of consistency to be able to say, okay, well, if we put those numbers into the lamp again tomorrow, it's going to match what we did today.
Exactly.
It's a very, very exciting thing. So I think the other thing that really strikes me from all of that is the digital in the cameras, the digital projection and the LED light sources. It feels like we're starting to get to a point of maturity with that, where it's starting to settle a bit in terms of the technology still progressing, but a lot of the early teething troubles of it seem to be getting past day-to-day issues. Do you feel that?
To a certain degree, I guess you could say that. There's still unforeseen things that are going to pop up and we're going to have to deal with.
Mm.
What I find interesting is the fact that with the more data we gather, the more we can talk about, you know, gamut and its influence. For instance, I went online to look up camera gamuts. And if you go today and look on what most people are saying, there's no such thing. Well, there is no such thing for the most part because the data is not out there.
Mm.
So we went, okay, well, I know there's camera gamut because we've measured it. We can actually put it out. So as part of my color presentation, it's one thing to say there's no camera gamut because you can't find any from a manufacturing point, you know, from the manufacturer's data reference points. But once you actually model the response curves of the camera,
of course
there's a gamut. And so in the color science presentation I do, I actually show it. And when you see that, you start to also understand the differences in camera. And it starts to go actually a long way in explaining why you're seeing these differences. And the sad part is that there's really no handheld meter that can tell you what's going on.
Mm.
There are a lot of indexes that give you some wonderful numbers, but there's no actionable data. What am I supposed to do with that?
Mm.
It gives you a value. So, well, that value is higher than the other value. So what does it do? Well, in the end, it plays into, I guess, a marketing angle, but it still doesn't give you the information that we now know is that, you know, those numbers may be very close, but in fact, on green magenta, and especially on a skin tone, that particular adjustment there is going to have a very high green value, but your meter won't be able to tell you that.
Wow.
Because it has to go back to the camera and its response. And unless you understand that, you're just whistling in the wind.
Yeah. So it's giving you information, but not necessarily anything that as a cinematographer you can work with.
They're great academic, they're academic exercises, which are interesting in and of themselves.
Yeah.
But again, when you're on the set and time is ticking by and you're trying to solve a problem, you've got a meter in your hand that you've spent $1,200 on and you want to know, okay, so what do I do with this information? I can't do jack with it, you know? So it's frustrating. Mind you, I think Siconic is going in the right direction with their meters. They have a C700 and 800.
Very, very interesting meters.
Yeah. It's still the challenge is how does it relate to a specific camera? But as a comparative meter, at least you can say between these two sources, if I'm trying to clean up some elements between it, that may give me enough information that I can go ahead and I can make some adjustments to harmonize them better. The other thing that we're trying to do as manufacturers is to have manufacturers start putting in gamut selection. So meaning that if the manufacturers all offer the ability to harmonize their color points to a given gamut, be it P3, 2020, Rec. 709, The hope is that if amongst manufacturers, if we all dial in on the same gamut, our color points can be remapped to that particular gamut so that from a board operator perspective, once they put in their color points, they'll harmonize across the line between different manufacturers.
Wow.
I think they'll get close. They won't necessarily be spot on because especially in Kelvin, there are different ways of getting white light, and it really comes down to the breadth of the spectrum. And the same goes for color points. There may be some saturated colors that one manufacturer can achieve that another can't. It cannot. But they'll be at least possibly, say, on the same hue angle, maybe not the same saturation.
Right.
And so this is where this remapping to a common gamut, I think, is a great goal to get.
Very exciting times.
Yeah.
Yeah. Frieda, thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure.